All right. Let's do the same thing, except better. And welcome to the third episode of the Negative World Podcast. We are recording this on Sunday, February 27th, 2011. As always, I am the host, Pandarius. And today with me I have...
My name is Anand, and my topic is going to be motion control. And we'll just discuss for a while how it's panned out, like what the future of it is, the best examples of it so far, and so on.
My name's Abdu, and I'm going to talk about the Blue Ocean strategy that Nintendo's taken under its wing to grab the casual market and what that means for the core players now and later.
I'm Triforce Spun, and I'll be talking about lives, checkpoints, and game overs, and how they used to be implemented back in the early days of gaming, and how they're implemented today, and what it means for a challenge in games. I also do a webcomic.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Oh, first, yeah, my topic, it's going to be RPG elements in games, if they really add anything to the gameplay, or if they're kind of being used as a crutch for game designers who don't know how to design a game. That's my unbiased way of putting my topic out there. Anyway, Triforce Bun.
Yes.
Tell us about why we might have heard about you or might have seen your work on the internet before.
Well, I'm not really sure why you might have heard about me or seen my work, but if you have, it's called Brawl in the Family. It's a webcomic about Kirby and several other Nintendo characters. And it's just something I kind of started off for fun because I was, you know, I'm a big fan of Nintendo. And it's sort of taken off from there, so... If you read the comic and enjoy it, then, hey, thanks for reading. And if not, why the heck aren't you reading my comic?
Well, you know, it's kind of boring. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, well, yeah.
No, it's a good comic.
Stuff, yeah. So.
Yeah, well, it's very cute and very funny, and it's got all the Nintendo characters that we love.
Oh,
so it's definitely check it out if you haven't.
Thanks, guy.
Although I gotta say, you're here only as like a regular of Negative World.
That is true. I'm not trying to, you know, make a big deal about my comic or anything. Just shooting the breeze with fellow Nintendo fans.
Right, right. So don't get the big head there.
All right, I'll try not to.
Cool.
All right. Well, I think that the best way to start this podcast is to go on the long, rambling explanation of what Negative World is about.
Sounds good.
No, I'm kidding. We did that the first 2 times already. I think people get the idea, or if they don't, well, they probably don't care enough. Yeah, let's just jump right into the topics. I think we're going to go ahead with Abdu's topic first. So, yeah, why don't you start us off?
Sure thing. My topic again is about Nintendo's Blue Ocean strategy. I really think this topic is interesting from a business perspective because... it's something that hasn't really been proven to be successful at a large rate, and I think Nintendo has succeeded in that matter. For the past 5 years, they've been catering towards the casual market or the non-gamer market, and really have, you know, outdone themselves. Of course, what does that really mean for the core gamer? It really means that, you know, a lot of their resources are not there for them, that, you know, they're going to have to wait for more offerings. But on the other hand, they're being highly successful there. They're profitable, and they're going to be able to acquire other resources or production companies to create core games for us. For those that don't know, the Blue Ocean strategy really means creating demand that's not fought over. A red ocean is something that is predominant in today's market where people have the same type of product and they're fighting over the same market, which bloodies the water, meaning it's a red. Mm-hmm. So a blue ocean is just, you know, creating your own world so that, you know, that market is all yours, so that, you know, your profitability, everything is really fast and rampant. And reading and researching about it has really opened my eyes, and just, I question, you know, what's the next step for, you know, their next console? Do they really want to go with the same type of setup they've done with the Wii? Or do they want to introduce a brand new concept, basically placing them in a new blue ocean?
Well, one thing to note is that, like, it seems like this generation, the other companies left Nintendo alone for 2 or 3 years and kind of let them have their blue ocean before jumping in. But I don't think that'll happen again, because they've seen, you know, how Nintendo's been successful with it. And the 3DS, you know, you could say that it's Blue Ocean because it has 3D, but I'm sure it'll only be a year or so before Apple adds 3D to one of their devices, and then, you know, so who knows what's going to happen there.
Well, what's interesting is that Nintendo's, in a way, they've kind of always been a Blue Ocean company. Like, even back in the days of the NES, like, a lot of that game design was really kind of unprecedented. You know, Super Mario Brothers and Legend of Zelda, there were side-scrollers and there were adventure games before those, but they really kind of took it to a new level, and they kind of became the standard that people would look at when they wanted to make games like that. And that kind of carried over to the 64. Yeah, the GameCube. Well, the GameCube is kind of interesting because you have that, and you have the Super Nintendo, and they were both sort of more evolutionary. You know, they're kind of refining the things that the concepts that were introduced in the previous generation. So overall, I mean, I think it's a pretty good way to approach things. But I think the argument nowadays is really, have they done that too much? Have they abandoned their old fans, you know, to try to build new ones?
Bull crap.
Yeah, I think if you look at the release list, they've released pretty much the same amount of games for their traditional fans as they always have. They just have additional games now. That's how it seems to me anyway.
Right.
Yeah, I hear people that are, you know, they like to insult the Wii because of games like, you know, like Big Brain Academy and Wii Sports and Wii Fit, but it doesn't really hold water when you think that we've gotten like three Mario platformers this gen alone. We've had a Zelda, maybe two Zeldas, you know, Skyward Sword ever gets released, and two Metroids. So, and then you have stuff like Wario and Animal Crossing and, you know, other smaller franchises that are still getting released. So it seems to me that they're doing what they need to do. They're reaching out to the new market as well as appealing to their old.
Yeah, and I think their, you know, core franchises, they're probably stronger this generation than they were last generation. I mean, one problem could be that they're focusing on them a little too much. Like you said, we have three or four Marios, two Zeldas, two Metroids. Yeah. But I think they've, you know, been pretty quality so far. Other people may debate Other M, but I think that was pretty good too.
All right. So basically, if I can cut in here, I'd like to talk about the actual cornerstone or the rule of a blue ocean. It's created when a company achieves value innovation, and that creates value simultaneously for both the buyer and the company. The innovation and product must raise and create value for the market while simultaneously reducing or eliminating features or services that are less valued by the current or future market. And what that equates to me, in my mind, is exactly what Nintendo produced with the Wii console. It's a system that calls out to the non-gamers, of course. It gives the motion controls as the innovation portion of that loaded sentence, and a simpler interface and a simplified looking controller, as well as simplified hardware specs to really give you the value portion of that cornerstone as well.
What do you think about the 3DS? Do you think it sustains that, or do you think it's like a rejection of it, kind of? Because that's their next, that's their first console since their revolution, you know?
Right. And I don't think it's a big leap compared to what the Wii really introduced. You know, motion controls, I know, have been around for a long time, but they weren't the main focus.
No, that's true. The thing is, though, like, I really think that it's the motion controls that captured the imagination of people. And then, like, you've got, like, these hardcore gamers, anyway, on message boards who say things like, motion controls haven't really been used very well, so that means that basically the Wii was a failure as far as introducing a revolutionary new controls was. And I think that you mentioned like simplifying the controller, and I really think that that is what the biggest thing that Nintendo achieved this generation, like making a controller that everyone understands, and like that, I think that benefits like even us who actually know our way around the controller. You know, not only like you can show it more easily to people who you don't normally play video games with. And you can, you know, like I, for the first time in my life, I played a video game with my dad when we got Wii Bowling, you know. But also, like, there's something very intimidating about today's controllers. And, like, even I, you know, like when I download a new demo on the PSN, like on the PS3, and, you know, I want to start playing Dead Space. There's, like, not only, like, 12 or 14 buttons that I can click on that will do something, but like one of them is a modifier and like it will do a different thing. So like you end up with like 40 commands on the same controller. So yeah, I think that Nintendo really like, okay, so the motion controls captured the imagination of people. But more than that, even if like new Super Mario Brothers doesn't really use the motion controls, you go back to a D-pad and like two buttons setup. I really think that that is what was needed to get back all the people that played the NES back in the day and never really touched a console since.
Maybe next generation, when everyone simplifies, Nintendo can release like a Steel Battalion controller or something. And...
yeah, just to shake things up.
Yeah.
Steel Diver is like a step towards that.
Actually, have you guys played, what is the name of the game? It's called Chosoju Mecha MG or something. It's a DS import game that never came here. And the whole thing is sort of like Steel Battalion, except the controls are on the bottom screen. And there's like all these levers and buttons that you can press. And it's actually kind of complicated, but it's all with touch panel, so you know it simplified somewhat.
Yeah, I don't think that really reaches out to casuals.
Probably not. Just robot nerds. But that's true. And I think the Blue Ocean thing, I mean, just Wii Sports alone, I think, got the Wii into so many households. And I think the 3D and the 3DS also has the potential to do that. I mean, when you show it to somebody and you show them a 3D picture or something like that, even if they don't use the 3D technology that much, you know, once they get the console, even if the games don't really take advantage of it, at least you move the system into the household.
And I know it's been said on the user boards, basically just taking a 3D photo and showing somebody is going to be huge.
It is going to be huge, yeah. Even though it's a super low quality, like 50 by 60 photo or whatever.
Right. Yeah, but in addition to that, you also have, I think something like Face Raiders, you know, is just something that's immediately entertaining to people that don't play games much, you know, because you have these heads floating around, it's their heads, and it's this simple shooter gameplay that uses the gyroscope too. And that and the AR cards are things that haven't really been done before. And, you know, they're new, but they're also very user-friendly. So I think that's also going to be something fun.
Well, it's a toy, right? Like, I mean, like, in the Iwata Asks segment about the Virtual Boy, Miyamoto said that they designed it to be a toy and that wasn't really supposed to be a gaming console initially.
Yeah, that was interesting.
And it does sound like the 3DS with all these AR games is actually close to a toy as well. I mean, it just launched in Japan yesterday. And basically, like, there's not really any talk about the games because the launch lineup is not really up to snuff. But the AR cards and everything, like that's all that people are talking about.
Well, Iwata actually said that he expects that stuff to be the Wii Sports of the 3DS, you know, the pack-in sort of software that sells the system, and everyone's going to get that software. So he said that, you know, there's not that many games from Nintendo at the Japanese launch of the 3DS, but he says that they used a lot of their internal resources to make those onboard software like Face Raiders and the AR games. So he expects that to sell the system, just like Wii Sports.
I have complete confidence in that because that's what they started out doing, is making cards.
Hanafuda cards. I wonder if they'll release AR Hanafuda cards. And
I actually ordered those from Club Nintendo.
So did I, yeah.
800 coins, yeah.
Because there wasn't anything worthwhile to get. Like Tingle's
Balloon.
They're
pretty cool for like a Nintendo history kind of buff, you know?
Yeah, it is a cool history thing. It's not like a pouch or something. But I wish they would bring over some of the software or exclusive controllers that they have in Japan or something like that.
They did bring over Grill Off with Ultra Hand.
And Game & Watch Ball or whatever.
Game & Watch Ball. I think I'm going to get that. I'm a sucker for stuff like that, that Game & Watch replica.
I mean, it's cool, but Tingle's Balloon Fight, man.
Oh, yeah.
I need that.
I know. We all need that.
So, yeah, the next point on this item is, you know, the competition has taken a dive into Nintendo's part of the ocean. So the big question is, what is Nintendo going to do next? Are they going to further advance their technology that they've already gotten on Wii? Or are they going to, you know, come out with some kind of crazy new idea that creates a brand new ocean.
If you're talking about the Wii, they've already pretty much said, haven't they, that they're only going to release a new console when they have a new idea that demands a new console, and then they'll maybe make it HD.
I would hope so.
I think they said that somewhere, yeah, with my total lack of source. But, you know, like, Move is the actual... That's the actual Red Ocean competitor to the Wii, right? Because the functionality is almost identical. But what's interesting is that it seems like nobody even cares about the Move now, you know? Whether that's because of marketing or just because of the concept, it's like they already have the Wii and this is 3 years or 4 years afterward. So even though it's more accurate and much more accurate than Kinect, actually, Kinect is the one that's been successful so far because it is actually something that separates Microsoft's platform, and Move doesn't really do anything except enable ports of, you know, dead space extraction.
Yeah, well, the Move is a kind of a weird thing because, like, I actually, you know, if you hang out on the PS3 message boards, which I sometimes do, it doesn't look like the casual market has really noticed the Move at all, but, like, there are the more hardcore people who actually do want to play games with a Move. And Killzone 3 came out recently, and it's compatible with the Move. And there's, like, this attachment that you can get, like this big gun that's supposed to be...
The Sony Zapper?
Yeah, basically. And I actually see some excitement on the message boards for
it. But does Sony even care? I mean, is that what they even want? I mean... Those people are probably going to play Killzone 3 anyway.
Yeah, I know. It doesn't look like the casual market has any interest in that. It does, you know, like the word fad gets thrown around a little bit too easily, but it does seem like the whole Wii take on motion controls, you know, doesn't really have the same impact that it used to have. People have moved on.
Well, Sony's message was confused also. It's they were going for everybody. It only does everything. They weren't really isolating their market. So they're making Killzone 3 and they're making, you know, that... iToy game and stuff like that, but Microsoft specifically has only gone for this, like, super, super casual software, you know? They're making Sesame Street games and stuff, and every other game is a dance game, and it seems like that's worked out for them. I mean, I don't know if Sony's gambit has really paid off. They kind of have feature parity with the Wii, but I don't know if it helps them at all in the market, you know?
Right, I agree.
Okay. All right, well, that's a perfect way to end the topic, I guess, because, yeah, let's move right on to the next one. And actually, it's we're going to talk about my topic. So I actually, it's not that well formed in my mind exactly what I wanted to say. It's basically more like the opportunity to rant about these damn RPG elements that seem to crop up everywhere. Like, and actually, the games that I have in mind aren't even on Nintendo systems. Like, recently, I'm about to say that these games are not as good as they could be. So I'm not trolling. Well, okay, I'm trolling the PSP owners out there.
Bad boy.
They don't need to be trolled. They've suffered enough.
Oh, that's true. Okay, well,
leave them alone.
The next topic is no, sorry. okay, so I played this PSP mini game called A Space Shooter for $2. And okay, so you've got that title. You pretty much know what to expect. It's a space shooter that's really, really cheap. And so, but it was getting good reviews. So I checked it out and I start playing it and I try the first mission and I fail. And it becomes pretty obvious to me very quickly that I was supposed to fail because there was no way that my ship, the ship that I had, could deal with like the quantity of enemies on screen and could take like that much damage. And, you know, I actually made it to the end boss of that level and it took forever to get that guy down. It was just ridiculous the time you had to spend trying to shoot at that thing to make it go away. And so, like, you die, and then you can go to this shop, and, like, all these experience points, or whatever you want to call them, that you accumulated, you can spend on upgrading your ship. And that is a very, very common system that a lot of these casual games are embracing. Well, no title pops out in my mind at the moment, but...
How about Alpha Balance for the DS? Doesn't that have a similar system?
Yeah,
sort of?
I played and hated that game as well. you don't accumulate experience points, but you do upgrade your ship. You find upgrades, but these upgrades are not really... You know, you find them by playing the game a whole lot and like going through these levels that are... I think they're procedurally generated. I think that they're not really designed. They're just there, you know?
Like Sigma Star Saga, sort of?
Yeah, well... Yeah, kind of. So,
I mean, what do you define as RPG elements, first of all?
Well, I think that basically it's when you have to grind. You have this grinding element that is being introduced. Like you cannot get past certain points, or you're gonna have a really, really tough time to get past certain bosses or levels or whatever if you don't do this repetitive shooting of enemies or any task that the game throws at you. Yeah, like it's basically this thing that you have to repeat over and over again to get currency to upgrade your character or whatever it is that the game is about. So Alpha Bounce like didn't have experience points, but you did have to complete an absurd number of levels to upgrade your ship. And a space shooter for $2 was basically you have to upgrade your ship and you have to kill to start over the first level over and over again. Otherwise, you won't be able to get anywhere.
Well, have you heard of Infinity Blade on the iPhone?
Yeah, and I'm not really, it's not making me want one. At all.
It's sort of like Punch-Out, except you have no chance of beating some of the bosses in your first time through, so you basically just get better weapons and like a very similar thing, a very arcade style of game, and they try to give it depth by just making forcing you to play over and over again and just giving you more weapons and stuff like that.
Yeah, and one last example that I wanted to bring up was another PSP game, a retail one this time, because okay, I can understand why these casual games that are cheap to make would do that. They're trying to increase the longevity of their games without pouring too much money into them. So, I can understand the need for that. They don't want their game to last only 1 hour, but at the same time, they don't have the cash to have a designer actually create this really well-rounded game, and then it only gets sold for $2 on the PSP or the PSP minis. I don't think are making a whole lot of cash for their developers. But
Probably not.
the other game is Ys 7, and it's an action RPG, and it's a very, very well-respected franchise. And Ys 7 got like really good reviews for mainly like the quality of its presentation. The graphics are excellent. The music is really, really great, and even the combat got some praise. But my personal experience with it was I basically had to walk around the first town for hours. And then finally, it let me out so I could go kill enemies. The regular enemies were absolutely no problem to take care of at all. You can just like mash the button and they die very easily and they give you experience points. And so it's a very, very mindless exercise. But then I got to the first boss, and again, like the same absurd scenario where apparently I needed to bash this huge boss for about half an hour, and like I would basically do no damage. Like his health bar would go down extremely slowly. It was clear to me that I wasn't supposed to be there at that time, like I wasn't supposed to take on this boss at the level that I was at. Fortunately, I had saved my game just before, so I pick back up, I load my game. And I go and I gain just one level, and all of a sudden, like I go back, and the boss goes down like a regular boss should. I could actually see that I was doing damage, and the boss fight wasn't drawn out. Basically, the game became fun.
Well, it sounds like your problem might be more the balance than the actual mechanism, because, the whole thing about role-playing games is that everyone should be able to play them and complete them, right? That's the whole thing about Dragon Quest. So if you're having problems, then you can just grind a little more and make your way through. But, I mean, if the game was balanced such that you could beat him the first time, but it was just a little challenging, or if you wanted to make it easier, then, I mean, can you think of any games that do it in a good way?
Well, I can. And you've got a good point. Like, I understand that it's a way to manage the difficulty of the game, but the thing is, like with E7, you had like four difficulty settings that you could choose from before starting the game. So that was,
Strange, yeah.
yeah, that was already a way to like tailor the experience for everyone. But more than that, like it wasn't like the first boss when I faced him wasn't hard. It was very, very, like you could dodge his attacks, and like it would be very obvious when it was safe to hit him and when it wasn't, and when you should retreat and then evade and everything. It just that it took a ridiculous amount of time. Like your attacks didn't do any damage at all. So, yeah, okay. So it could be a problem of balance, I guess. But more than that, I think that it was just a miscalculation, I guess. Like, it seems to me that these action RPGs Especially E7, which has a very, very solid combat system. Like, they don't even need these RPG elements. They don't need this leveling up system.
Pandarius, what do you think of Resident Evil 4?
I actually haven't... Well, I've played through it once, and that was enough.
That was enough.
It's not really my type of game. But no, it was a very well-made game, and I respect it for what it did. I think that the balance was definitely better in Resident Evil 4 than it was in E7. And I guess it is one way to... I don't know. I guess when it does leveling up well, these RPG elements don't ruin a game. But when they don't do it well, they can definitely just ruin the experience for you.
Well, I think definitely, yeah. I mean, it really messes up the balance of the game. It's hard to balance a game when you never know what level someone's going to be, and there are very few games that get it right, and like the later Castlevanias.
Well,
and stuff,
exactly.
You know?
And so, yeah. Like, my question is, like, why even have that system at all? Like, why even have RPG elements at all?
Because some players think they add depth, right?
I kind of blame MMOs, honestly, because... With the popularity of that, RPG elements have been kind of creeping in to everything, really. Because developers know people like to get stronger. That's what makes games addicting for a lot of people, is to gradually increase in power. But the problem with this is that puts less of an emphasis on skill, which is why I think a good way to do it is, like, I think in Resident Evil 4, because you can't really grind enemies in the game. I mean, you kill enemies and they're pretty much gone. And you pretty much just choose what things you want to make stronger with your guns at these increments, you know, when you meet the merchant. But you're not going to stick in, you know, you're not going to be sticking around the hedge maze or the castle just killing enemies over and over for money, because the game doesn't allow that. It's basically, you know, says, hey, you're going to stick to this path and play the game the way it's meant to be played. And I think that might be one of the elements, is to discourage grinding by not letting the player do that, and by having them be able to kill bosses the first time they come up to them.
Well, that's, if you think about Metroid, I mean, the whole way the series is balanced, from Metroid, Super Metroid, stuff like that, you don't actually gain experience, but you get more health and you get more missiles, and by the end of the game, it's kind of a cakewalk, you know? So, but that's sort of that empowerment is sort of the heart of the Metroid series, and people love that, so, I mean... Don't you think it has the same sort of elements in a way? Like, it starts very, very hard, at least the first Metroid, and then it gets easier and easier and easier as the game goes on, but it's kind of, like, empowering in a way, and it never gets too bad.
Okay, yeah, but, like, the main difference, like, we can easily compare Metroid and Castlevania, and I think the main difference is that in Metroid, like, if, yeah, you do get stronger and stronger, and but it's not really something I would call an RPG element, because it doesn't ask you to... do a repetitive task to get there.
Yeah, you get rewarded for exploring, basically.
Yeah, like you...
Like in Zelda.
Yeah, exactly. Same with Zelda. Like, you find something...
But it does mess up the balance of the game, right? Like, the hearts in Wind Waker, say, if you have, you know, so much more power than you need.
Wind Waker is pretty easy from, you know, from any level of hearts you have, but I think generally the game will give you... Like, even Metroid, you know, where things are usually out of the way places, it will kind of... put certain energy tanks and missile tanks kind of on the path, like how Zelda gives you a heart after you beat a boss. So it can kind of estimate how strong the player would probably be at this point.
Yeah.
That is true, but do you like the balance of those games? I mean, is it actually a good balance to get easier as the game progresses?
It kind of varies for me from you know, Metroid title to Metroid title and Zelda title to Zelda title, but usually I think it is a pretty good balance, because you typically are not hitting for more for the most part than you could. Like, basically in Zelda, there's, like, in Ocarina of Time, you get the one sword upgrade, basically, the big orange sword, and that's pretty much it after the Master Sword. So the bosses are still going to take the same amount of hits. You might be able to take a few more hits if you've been thorough in exploration, but honestly, I'd like Zelda to be harder in general. You know, I don't think it's ever particularly hard from the beginning to the end for the recent ones. Normally I do think it's a good balance. I think it's a good balance for Metroid. I mean, some of the toughest bosses are at the end of Metroid. You know, like, you have Ridley and stuff. I'm thinking of Super Metroid. They incrementally make things harder for the player if it's done well, by making stronger enemies, you know, and, you know, more hazards and things take away more life. Link to the Past had enemies that take away 3 hearts by the end of the game. So if it's done the right way, it can still keep the balance. It doesn't necessarily have to be easy to hard.
Abdu, you had something?
Yeah, I was actually gonna say, I totally agree that it's a big balancing act. Pandarius, you're the reason that I bought Dragon Quest IX. I'm really new to true role-playing games, and that was one of the first ones that I actually dug into. And I could tell that, you know, going up against a boss that I was not ready for, it was almost impossible for me to flee. And that was really, you know, disheartening, just getting there, you know, getting there and getting killed, just getting creamed. And just having it, the ability to go back and grind and build your character up would alleviate that. It would be nice if games would give you more of a, like a milestone, like celebration, you know, once you're done grinding and, you know, leveling up your character.
I hope that you're enjoying the game, if I'm the reason that you got it.
oh, no, I do.
Yeah, I'm going to sound a bit like a hypocrite, but, you know, I do like the Dragon Quest games, and those games are all about grinding. And I think the reason I don't mind, beyond the fact that I'm a fanboy, is when I played Guardia Quest, the Dragon Quest clone in...
in Retro Game Challenge.
Yeah, there's a point, like, I don't remember if it's, like, in one of the magazines that you receive or if it's even, like, in the game, but, like, there's a point where someone says, don't grind. Like, you don't need to grind. You explore and you try to get as far as you can, and then you die, but then you can do better next time. And, like, I don't know, like, this kind of change of, it changed the way I looked at the game. And, like, one of the things that Dragon Quest does well and that E7 doesn't do is that when you die, you keep your experience points. All of your progress, you keep it, save for the gold that you accumulated. Like, that gets cut in half. Yeah, I think, like, that's definitely the philosophy that's behind that game. Like, anyone is supposed to be able to make it to the end of the game if they just try for long enough. So, and I find the grinding at that game enjoyable for some reason.
But, you know, in a turn-based RPG, that's what's so maddening about them for me, is that if you're underpowered, like, you just go fight a boss and it's like boss casts lightning or something and you just die immediately without being able to do anything to help it. But if it's an action game with RPG elements, then theoretically you could eventually triumph, you know, just through skill if it's balanced, you know, decently.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know. I think that as long as the game doesn't make you start over from the last save without letting you keep your progress, I think that it's not as infuriating.
Well, now we're going to Tri's topic, but doesn't that also raise the stakes a bit and make it more fun in a way? Like, more tense?
No. Well, I don't know.
Well, several RPGs do follow that guideline that Dragon Quest started. Just off the top of my head, I can remember that Final Fantasy VI did it. If you die in Final Fantasy VI, you will start back from a save point, and you will lose your progress, but you'll keep your EXP. And Earthbound does it as well. Earthbound, if you die, you start back from, you know, your house or something, or the beginning of the town. But you haven't really lost anything except half the money you have on hand.
Earthbound is like a reskin of Dragon Quest, essentially, right?
Yeah, it does take a lot of cues from Dragon Quest. It's almost like a parody or something. Good game.
Yeah.
Definitely recommend it.
Oh, you like it?
I love Earthbound. Are you kidding me?
I was, actually, yeah.
Oh, okay, all right.
All right.
I wasn't sure if I'd made myself clear enough over the past couple of years.
There's a fan translation of Mother's 0-1, I guess, coming out.
Yeah, I heard about that. The Game Boy Advance compilation, someone fan translated it.
Right, but I thought the other one, the Mother 0, was already translated, but Nintendo never released it. But maybe they're retranslating it.
They translated Mother, and they never released it, but one guy had the cartridge and allowed others to pretty much duplicate that. So it's like an official translation, basically.
This must be a retranslation then, I guess.
Yeah, I guess it is. They probably cleaned it up because it has a lot of NES-era dialogue.
So I guess that as for the topic of RPG elements, we're going to conclude with it's just me.
I do agree with you. I was actually just giving some examples of games that I thought did it well, but I agree that there's way too many of them in games these days, and it's like an easy out. You know, it's an easy way to get people hooked, and it just feels kind of cheap sometimes when it's not really implemented without thought put into it.
And the difference between something like Aria of Sorrow and Dawn of Sorrow is pretty extreme to me, because Aria of Sorrow is balanced so that most of the good weapons, you know, you have to find them along your way, and it is sort of like a milestone. But Dawn of Sorrow is just the most grind-heavy thing in the world, where you just walk in and out of the same room like 1,000 times, you know, to get a rare drop, and then you have to find 10 of them, which is just insane to me. You know, it's not fun. It doesn't encourage fun gameplay.
Yeah, I definitely prefer Super Castlevania 4 kind of style to the Metroidvania styles, personally.
I so agree. And like the okay, quickly, one last point I wanted to make. Like, I kind of excused a space shooter for $2 for being that way because, you know, like, it's a struggling, yeah, $2, and also it's a struggling mm-hmm. developer and everything. But like, you get then like people like Gaijin Games who make the BitTrip series and sell their games for $6, and like, those games aren't perfect and they're pretty short, but like, there's good design, you know. Like, they didn't, like, I can only imagine like if they had made you like farm for XP so that you could actually finish their levels, like, I can't imagine it. Like, I think it is possible to make a solidly designed game that's to play casually or more hardcore, I guess, and not have to resort to this RPG element crutch. But yeah. Anyway, I guess that's enough for that. we're going to move on to Anand's topic. So yeah, like you had like pitched in like maybe like half a dozen. which one did you settle on in the end?
Which one did I settle on? My topic is about motion control. And I guess you can include the other Wii features if you want, like the speaker and pointing and just the Wii's unique features, you know, that they were pitched as with, I don't know if you guys remember the commercial that came out at the launch, not the launch, but the announcement of the Wii, where, you know, it had all this sort of promise of things we could do. And then when we actually got the Wiimote, the vanilla Wiimote, it was actually pretty limited in the kind of actions that it could reliably, you know, you could reliably reproduce on it. And so I just want to talk about motion control, how it's been so far, like what the best examples were, and, you know, whether it's worth preserving, and if it's going to continue, how much of a future there is for it.
Okay, best example, Wii Sports, future, not really. Next.
Yeah. Right, I actually have Wii Sports too, but the funny thing about Wii Sports and all of the good, I mean, the Wiimote itself, it seems like, can you guys think of any games where you can reliably make like a number of complex actions, you know? Like Wii Sports, with just the normal Wiimote, not Wii Sports Resort, it's almost all illusion, you know? If you just took Wii Sports Tennis and you isolated like it down to a button press, you would almost get the same thing, but it wouldn't be fun at all because you wouldn't have the illusion, you wouldn't have the thwack of the ball and the speaker, you wouldn't have, you know, the big motion of your arm so you feel like you're getting into it. It really is an illusion, but it actually does make it more fun, which is pretty interesting to me. Hmm. I mean, and other examples I can think of, I mean, almost none of this stuff is built upon, but other examples are things like The Godfather with its brawling system, where you could actually, that kind of did work, where you could actually throw people, you know, from side to side. You could rough them up, you know, in real time. You have SSX Blur with the sort of carving on the nunchuck and some really crazy motion controls for the superpowers. In fact, EA, I think, has almost done more with motion control than Nintendo, like especially when you include Motion Plus, you know, with Grand Slam Tennis and Tiger Woods and things like that.
Okay, but should we have a disclaimer here that you're paid for and bought by EA to say these things?
I am an employee of... No, I'm not an employee of EA, but they did pay for my hotel, that's true. Still, no, but I think like Motion Plus, when you think of Motion Plus, how many other companies have done, you know, when you think of like Boom Blocks and things like that, how many other companies have even tried? How many have even, you know, given like a crap about motion controls and tried to do something with them, you know, beyond EA? It might not have always worked, and maybe it wasn't developed upon further, but, you know, it's not Carnival Games or, you know, Avatar, yeah, the movie, which is the worst example of Motion Plus control I think I've ever seen. It actually turned me off the movie. I couldn't watch it.
I was just going to chime in and say, you know, the motion controls are infinitely harder to, I would think, are harder to execute from a development standpoint than a button press. So, you know, that's something that probably weighs heavy on the developer.
Right, it does. And it takes a lot of R&D. And this is one thing I want to talk about also, is that just like early in the DS's life, I mean, it takes a lot of research, a lot of, you know, experimenting and stuff in order to get things that work well with the Wii controls or DS controls. And, you know, when you take that time to sort of to sort of develop the game, then you don't have as much time to put tons of content into it. You don't have time to maybe polish it. And it seems like the audience and even critics aren't really patient enough to wait for that to, you know, mature. So it never did. Kind of just died. It's like stillbirth, kind of, you know, after the first couple of years. And people stopped trying, you know?
Yeah, and like even Nintendo seemed to give up because I think there's no denying that they haven't been pushing motion controls that much. Sure, like they force you to use the Wiimote on the side in New Super Mario Brothers, and like there's like maybe like I don't know, like three levels that actually make use of it, of the tilting.
And then the shake, the horrible shake.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, there's also
Donkey Kong.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Again, the shake.
Again, it's just
shake
like
to blow, shake to roll. Yeah.
You know, like actually, when you're holding the Wiimote NES style, it's so much easier to hit the A button or even, you know, the B button, I think, with your finger or something than it is to introduce that shake into it. I wish that was an option more often.
Mm. Yeah, and then it's happened to me that I've been like, okay, I just needed to scratch myself, and suddenly, whoops, I rolled into a pit.
Yeah, that happens to me too.
TMI squared.
there is a game I have to give a lot of credit to. It's a third-party game, and I'm probably sure you guys have played it because people talk about it a lot on Negative World. Silent Hill: Shattered Memories by Konami. Who's played it? Nobody?
I own it. I'm too scared to unwrap it.
Oh, wow. Okay. No one else has played
it. It's actually $20 now, I think.
That's actually a really great use of not just motion controls, but a lot of the features of the Wiimote, such as the pointer works really well. And the speaker works really well. You put the thing up to your ear, and it just works. It makes things a lot more immersive than just hearing it come through the stereo.
I think the speaker is really powerful when used properly. Yeah.
Yeah. It's actually a really great use of the pointer and of the motion controls themselves. And it's a solid game, you know, besides. So I was impressed by that. And whenever I see motion controls done really well, whenever I see game developers use those features well, it makes me appreciate the game a lot more, you know, because it feels like something unique, something you can't really get anywhere else, like Boombox.
Right, something novel, yeah.
Yeah, I think Trauma Center does it really well too, but it's more of a, it's less motion controls for Trauma Center and more the pointer, but I'm a big fan of those the three Trauma Center Wii games. And,
the Trauma Center games are really good. The pointer stuff, it does work really well, but that's almost to be, you know, expected because it's sort of like a mouse, essentially.
Yeah.
It does work well, yeah.
Yeah, well, I gotta say, like, I'm not that big a fan of the motion controls myself. Okay, I like Wii Sports Resort, but I don't really like the first Wii Sports. I'm really a fan of the pointer, though.
Your dad is shedding a silent tear right now.
Yeah, no, it's bowling is always fun. But it's also in Wii Sports Resort, so, hey.
Yeah, that's true.
And it's only better, and I can consistently kick my dad's ass at it, so it's perfect.
Is bowling really always fun?
Well, when you're winning.
That's true.
But anyway, like the pointer is really like what I really am thankful for. Yeah, to Nintendo for including, because to me, the pointer can enhance games in so many ways. And like, we're not just talking about like shooters, which like people are used to their dual analog setup, or they could use the Wii pointer to just like point and shoot. And like some people really, really think that works. But personally, like I think the best use is in a couple of WiiWare games that are basic 2D platformers. For instance, Nyx Quest. In Nyx Quest, there's really not that much that makes it stand out, except for the way that it uses the pointer controls. You know, like you walk around and you jump and everything, you avoid the enemies, but you can also at the same time use the pointer to affect the environment. There are certain blocks, for instance, that you can just like drag around the screen for a limited amount of time. Well, you can jump on those blocks and like use them as a makeshift elevator for your character. Or you can use them and like throw them at the enemies, or use them as a shield. And so it really makes you think about what you're doing. You're really doing two things at the same time. Like you're platforming like you've always done for the past like 25 years or however old you are, and you know, when was your first time that you played Super Mario? And at the same time, you're also using this new device to affect the screen in a new way. And there is something really, really appealing in that, I find. It's really something that wouldn't have been possible before. And, well, except maybe with, like, on the PC, using a mouse. But even then, I don't know, first, who plays 2D platformers or on their PC, really? And second, I guess so. But the mouse really, like, I don't think really lends itself as well as the pointer does.
I think you're actually correct, and it is pretty unique. And I read an article on like Gamasutra or something about games on the Wii that it's sort of a new paradigm of you're sort of performing, like you said, two actions in the same world. Like you're controlling a character with one hand, and basically you're kind of in God mode with the other hand. And I think that is pretty interesting. Even something like Mario Galaxy, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah, I was going to mention, except that Galaxy doesn't make use of it as much as these WiiWare games do, which is really a shame. And when the game Lost Winds came out and basically used the pointer as well to... that was your way of taking care of the enemies, but also platforming and everything. I really thought that we would see that kind of mechanic in a retail game at some point. And it never really happened. And then, like, Sony at some point, like, they've got their game, their platformer, Little Big Planet. And at some point, like, they announced, when the Move was announced, that Little Big Planet would support it. And suddenly I thought, wow, okay, so the Wii never got this retail 2D platformer game that uses the pointer that I've always wanted, but the Move does. Like, I thought it was kind of unfair. But then I heard, like, people who played it, who, like, they reported that the pointer was not used as much or as well as it was in Next Quest. I don't know what's keeping these companies from actually using the tools they have at their disposal to create these this new stuff.
Well, Sony actually pays people to, you know, create things that take advantage of their stuff. Like Nintendo, they pretty much just say, make this game, and if you want to put in this feature, except for maybe the Shake in Donkey Kong Country or something. But I think it is, like, everyone's risk-averse. If the first party isn't funding it, then third parties aren't going to want to, you know, be the first person to, you know, step on the creaky bridge or whatever. And if you look at, I think the opposing thing is, like, the iPhone, because it's also kind of a unique interface design with the multi-touch and stuff. It's kind of like the DS, but with the multi-touch and stuff, except it's not big publishers. It's mostly indie devs and stuff, and they actually take risks. And I think that the mutation and, like, evolution has been so much more rapid on that platform, you know? And when a concept comes along, other people develop it, and they keep iterating, but that really hasn't happened on the Wii as much, or the DS, because people are a little more gun-shy.
So why bias? Are they all against the Wii? Against Nintendo?
It's just because it's the main publishers on the Wii, right? I mean, you can see that stuff on WiiWare because those guys are kind of like self-funded, but you're not going to see like Activision really pushing, you know, the boundaries of motion control and pointer control. We can think of all these ideas and stuff, but somebody has to greenlight them, and I think that just is not going to happen. Like, I don't know if motion control really has a future at all. I mean, the Move, you could say, is the evolution of motion control, and it's actually pretty fun, you know, like the Move Sports or whatever they call it, Sports Champions, Move Sports Champions, mm-hmm. Move Champions. But it hasn't really lit the world on fire because it kind of seems like nobody cares anymore.
That and the motion controlling there's no standard format. You know, we've got three different systems that have three different ways to move character around.
I wonder if Zelda's going to change anything, or if that's just going to, you know, be like a lone great example in a sea of, you know, missed opportunities. Or even
a
if
lone
it's gonna,
great example.
Well, yeah. If it'll even be everything it should be, you know? I'm really hoping that it can kind of show the world that, hey, motion controls can be used to really make these great immersive experiences.
It's too late, though, right? It's too late for this gen, at least.
I guess so.
I mean,
yeah, no publisher is going to look at Zelda and say, oh, yeah, okay, so these games, like, we can make games like these and it will sell. Like, they'll come up with excuses again, you know, like,
Zelda,
okay,
yeah.
So it's Nintendo, it's Zelda. Yeah, exactly. It's not going to prove anything to anyone except to us, I guess.
That said, I mean, it looks pretty cool. The things they're doing with Motion Plus actually look like what I've been wanting, you know, all along. Out of the device or motion control kind of thing. Like the motion control in the Twilight Princess was kind of horrible for the sword swinging, you know? It was just a more inaccurate kind of way of doing that. I mean, the pointer stuff was good, but Skyward Sword, I think it looks pretty bold from what we've seen so far. I think they might actually ratchet it down from what they showed at E3 because that was more of like a demo of what they could do. But I want to like roll bombs and stuff. It sounds fun, you know?
Yeah.
I was going to say, if you think about it, I'm envisioning the new Zelda title to be like a Wii Sports Resort plus Zelda.
I was going to say, yeah. To me, so we see Link bowling and we see him doing the archery thing, and it's basically Wii Sports Resort with a Zelda skin.
And that's a huge undertaking. I would think that's going to be viewed as a huge risk for third parties.
Well, I don't know if it's a risk for Nintendo, but you know, Sony has that, they have some game Sorcery, is that what it's called? Which is supposed to be like,
I think so, yeah.
It looks kind of generic, but that's kind of like a full adventure using motion controls. I mean, but those are still first party things. I mean, and I don't know if third parties will ever actually follow up, although they could, and I think it'd be pretty cool.
To me, like, these motion controls for now, like, are best used in, like, they're at their best when they're used for simple things. Again, I'm going to go back to the WiiWare example, the BitTrip Beat game. You simply tilt the remote control as if it were like a corn cob or something like that, and it controls the paddle on screen. And it's like direct analog movement.
Well, the tilt is actually very accurate, so if you use that in games.
It's extremely precise, and I can't think of a better way to emulate these controls, you know, that no one has really been able to do right since Pong. So for this kind of simple stuff, like, there's nothing that can beat the remote.
Well, there's still a paddle, right? I just got the DS Lite paddle actually imported.
Okay, well, you don't have a paddle for the home console, though.
That's going to be Wii 2. That's the secret sauce.
Oh, I see. another point I wanted to bring up, like, what do you think of people who say that, since no game really has proven that the motion controls are revolutionary, like, since no game has really come from this new technology that really couldn't have been done with the controllers that we... a regular controller. Like, do you think that is a failing? That it's a proof that... you know, motion controls, that there's not really a future for them?
Well, even if it is just an illusion, like I was saying with Wii Sports and Boom Blocks and things like that, even if it is an illusion, it's still fun to, at least for me, it was fun to play. And, you know, it was kind of a revolution, even if it didn't actually change, you know, the games themselves, like the act of playing them, I think it was kind of revolutionary. Now, the question you're trying to ask, I guess, is can you do things on motion control that are better than you could do on any other system? And I don't know if that's been proven, but I think definitely there's been a revolution in just motion control in general, and things like Just Dance, you know, which like we don't care about, but it's freaking huge, you know? It's like the biggest selling third-party IP on the Wii, and it's like, it's basically keeping the Wii afloat right now, kind of, you know?
I'd say some games are better with motion controls than without. Like Trauma Center on the Wii, I'd much rather use that, you know, use the pointer than use an analog stick, you know? And just having stuff like the defibrillator, you know, it doesn't always work all the time, but it kind of adds that little extra fun bit of interactivity. Games like Shattered Memories couldn't really be done with it. I mean, they could, but they're not as good. They have a PlayStation 2 version, and I'm not really interested in that version because you miss out on those extra bits of immersion.
There's a PlayStation 2 version?
And PSP,
yeah,
I think.
And a PSP version of Shattered Memories.
Oh, right. Okay.
That's the cross-platform that the Wii gets. That's the company it keeps.
You know what else is frustrating? The Wii version of Resident Evil 4 is significantly better than the GameCube version in terms of controls. And it frustrates me because no one has taken that very simple way of aiming and shooting and integrated it into a new third-person shooter.
I'm sure it frustrates everyone because, yeah, it works really well. And not only that, but I think that the method of not scrolling the screen and just keeping it fixed and using the thumbstick to scroll the screen is actually the best solution because, you know, it eliminates all the kind of looseness that you get when the screen is scrolling.
Yeah, you don't have to worry about the bounding box and things.
Exactly, yeah, no bounding box. I think that's the best solution, but it seems like nobody cares. I mean, that was at launch, right?
Well, it was like the summer after launch. It was pretty close. It was a few months.
The thing is, like, not only the developers or the publishers don't want to create like good motion controls, but there are tons of gamers out there who simply don't want to learn. And like some of them are even like working for websites or publications about gaming, and they review games and they tell you, hey, this doesn't work, it sucks, and you should avoid it. And then for some reason you try it for yourself and you realize no, actually it works pretty much like it should.
Casual gamers are probably more receptive to that stuff. It seems like people have been gaming for a long time. They don't want a learning curve at all. They just want their dual stick sort of standard Halo setup or something something else, and they get kind of confused when they have to relearn something. And you do have to learn a lot of Wii controls. It's not like you can do it right always the first time, but eventually, you know, you can nail it.
Yeah, no, I understand that sentiment, but at the same time, it's like holding us back, you know? Well, us, I mean. It's holding the developers back and, I guess, Nintendo fans back? I don't know.
if they wanted that in the first place. I mean, I think it's interesting, but a lot of people are even looking at Skyward Sword and sort of like dreading the, you know, inclusion of Motion Plus, but I think it's pretty cool.
Let's hope that it makes a few converts, I guess.
I'm looking forward to it. I say the more changes, the better.
Definitely, yeah.
I'm ready for all sorts of new crazy stuff in Zelda.
He's going to fly.
I think we're all ready for some new stuff in Zelda, just in general. All right. Well, that was pretty good. We're going to move on to our final topic, I think. Yeah, Triforce Bun. What did you choose to talk about today?
I chose to talk about lives, game overs, and checkpoints in games. Has anyone here played Battletoads?
Oh, yeah. Very little, yeah.
Has anyone beaten Battletoads?
No.
Of course not.
That's a question for everyone in the world. That's not just for you. I don't think anyone has beaten Battletoads. And you know why? Because Battletoads is freaking impossible. And it wouldn't be entirely impossible if the game gave you infinite continues. But it doesn't. You have a certain number of lives, you have a certain number of continues to get to the end of this ridiculous game where the third level is like a wall for so many players, so to speak, because of that crazy racing thing. And every level after that is even harder. So that brings me into my main topic. It's about lives and checkpoints and game overs. Or games over. Back in the arcade days, before we had, you know, our nifty home consoles, you had games like Donkey Kong and Space Invaders, and you were given a certain number of lives on one quarter. If you died, you had to pay money to continue playing the game. So players were encouraged to be good at the game to save their money, basically, to see as far as they could get, see how far they could get on a single quarter or on, you know, however much money they had in their pocket that they're going to inevitably spend in the arcade cabinet. But when the NES came along, this was kind of carried over, but it's always felt like kind of an awkward transition to me because we're not paying money to continue in NES games or video games in general. We are either going to be sent back to the beginning in some games, or we're going to get to continue and restart from an arbitrary checkpoint. But nowadays, games have changed a little bit. They're not really as arcadey, if you ask me. There's a lot more of these big sort of cinematic games, even shooters, you know, that used to be the most arcadey kind of genre entirely, have become sort of these very cinematic things. You're led from one point to the other, and they got checkpoints out the wazoo, basically. If you die, it's not a huge deal. And it
just starting on the wazoo?
Yeah. Okay. It got me wondering, what exactly is the best balance to this approach? The purpose of lives in games is to punish the player for doing poorly. And, you know, games can do all sorts of different things to punish the player for this. But the most common occurrence is to set them back a certain amount, you know, so they have to redo a part of it, basically. And with game overs, it's pretty much the same thing, except generally on a bigger scale. You know, you might have to restart from your last save point, or you might have to restart the game entirely back in the old days. But when I first started thinking of the concept of lives kind of being outdated was around the time of the 64, when we had these larger 3D platformers. We had Mario 64, we had Banjo-Kazooie, and these games had lives, but it was kind of pointless. When you died, you just kind of got booted out of the level, and you might have lost your coins or your jiggies, and that was kind of a pain. But not your jiggies, but your notes. And you kept everything else. I hope you guys know what I'm talking about.
Your Baphmodads?
Yeah, you lost your Baphmodads. If we can take an example from, Star Fox Adventures?
Star Fox Adventures. Horrible.
Yeah, so you lose some arbitrary collectibles, and you can hop back, you know, right back into the painting or whatever. And when you get a game over, you get kicked back to the castle courtyard, you know, big deal. We spend a couple more minutes backtracking through this. And, you know, for games like this, is there really a reason to have a live system at all? In games like Galaxy, you know, in Galaxy 2, you get lives. You know, you see a one-up, you see coins, and you want to get them, but you don't really need them. If you get a game over, you're going to be kicked out of the galaxy, you can just jump right back in. If you die, you're going to be kicked back to the past, you know, the last checkpoint you got to. Either way, it's not really a big penalty, and while it's nice to not have to, you know, worry about so much backtracking, at the same time, it makes the whole reward system of 1-ups kind of useless. It's like, I'm exploring this, you know, this castle, and oh, there's something behind here. Oh, it's just a 1-up. Yeah. You know, it's not really something I want. Why do I need 1-ups? Why do I need lives? It's not as important as it was back in Mario 3 when you get a game over. The levels you cleared on that world would flip back over, basically.
It's just Pavlovian now, like a gold star.
Yeah, you just want them to have them. They're shiny, and they're squishy, and they look funny, and they make a weird noise when you get them. So let's get them. So I was wondering what
the
you
coins,
guys thought of this. Yeah, coins, 1-ups, whatever, Baphomet-dads, you know, whatever you want to call them. People like collecting things, I guess.
Nobody likes collecting Baphomet-dads.
Yeah, nobody likes collecting Baphomet-dads. They're weird looking.
I got no idea what you're talking about. But let me tell you. Oh, yeah. Well, I didn't stick with that game for long enough, I think.
You didn't find one Baphomet-ad? Shame.
Well, I don't recall.
So I was wondering what you guys thought about the whole idea of creating a checkpoint, basically, for a player to continue after they die. And if games nowadays are too easy. Because as much as I hate Battletoads because it's aggravating, at the same time, it's kind of cool because I've never beaten the game. There are parts of that game that I may never see. And I can't say that about any game that I've bought, you know, in the past 15 years. I mean, there's games
that's probably
that
not a good thing to say, though, from the designer's perspective, right? But that's how games used to be. It's like you bought them, and it's like, maybe I'll get to the third level. Hey, maybe I'll see, like, 40% of my game.
Yeah, I like that if I beat the game kind of thing, rather than have you beaten the game yet? You know, oh, it's just a matter of time.
Okay, but, like, let's make one thing clear, though. You're, like, a platforming expert. You're like a genius, or because like you have like you go, yeah, like you win the extra mile with like Donkey Kong Country Returns,
yeah,
and like
not only
you connected everything, not only you did all the time trials and got all goals, but you even went beyond that and got like shiny golds, which was like required,
yeah,
like getting but a certain margin.
Yeah,
oil.
You really didn't need to get shiny golds at all, but I just kind of got them because I like the time trials. I really like platformers. I just love having that goal you set for yourself, and you're like, oh, I gotta do this perfectly. I don't know. Something about the game is really addicting to me.
The example you used was like a Galaxy, and they're totally useless in Galaxy, things like lives and 1-up. But, you know, in New Super Mario Bros. Wii, which people complained about the live system, and the checkpoint system was basically structured like Super Mario Bros. 3, where you have, like, from castle to castle you can save. And if you die in between, then you'll have to redo those 5 or 6 levels over again. I actually like that system because, yeah, I think it makes sense, and it encourages, like, when it's done well, it encourages a mastery of the game. Like, if it's just if you just have to pass it one time, then you can kind of just stumble forward, and like in a shooter, you know, in Call of Duty or something, you just kind of walk around and, oh, I passed the trigger point, I'm the next checkpoint. But in a game like, you know, that's structured well, like Super Mario Bros. 3 or New Super Mario Bros., then you actually have to kind of get those 5 levels down and kind of, you know.
Yeah, see, I think those are good examples of it. What I don't like are games where you can save at any time and reload at any time. Basically, save
like PC state. Games. Yeah, those are hard.
Yeah, I don't like save states. You get to the point where you're using them obsessively. You know, you get past something hard, you get past one enemy, and you save state.
It's impossible to resist the urge. I mean, it's like,
it's right there. It's like F5 and F6 or something. Mm-hmm.
So I guess the question I'm posing is what do you guys think is a good system for lives and game overs, and if we really need them in games, you know, that are more adventure type games.
Well, can I tell you like my theory for why Super Mario Galaxy 2 is set up the way it is?
Yeah.
A theory that's absurd and that I don't really believe.
Go for it.
I just a couple of hours ago, I tried my hand at the perfect run.
Oh.
That's the last star that you can get in that game. And basically, that's what, yeah, the name says it all. You have to do a perfect run of the last extra bonus level. Mm-hmm. And it's extremely difficult. And every time that you die somewhere along the way, and it's a long level, well, you start over at the beginning.
Yeah.
There are no checkpoints. And I had a stock of 40 lives. And over the course of the next like 2 hours, I pretty much spent them all. And the only reason I stopped playing at all was because I hit that game over screen. So my theory is that Nintendo is really actually looking out for us, because they're putting that game over thing so that people would finally stop beating their head against the wall.
It's like a why not take a break kind of thing.
Yeah,
like,
take a play there.
Like Arena, it's just the open window game.
I'm sure the 3DS will have that like every 5 minutes, so you don't, you know, go cross-eyed or something.
Yeah, why don't you look at something that's 2D for a couple of seconds?
Why don't just close your eyes for half an hour or so?
The perfect run is just ridiculously hard. But it's kind of cool because it's the very last challenge. And it's kind of like what I was saying about Battletoads, where some players may never beat it because it's just so hard. And I kind of like how
masochist.
They... yeah, maybe so, you know, with all the shiny golds and stuff and the perfect run. It's just kind of cool having that part of the game that's just like, all right, you think you've done it all. Here's this final ridiculous challenge, you know?
Yeah, but yeah, like I definitely agree that the concept of like limited amount of lives, and especially the way they do it in Mario games, like they don't even you don't even carry them over when you save. Like it's
that's really weird.
You always start with only 5 of them, and you have to collect them all over again if you want to have a stockpile of them. But
I think they just want to have the like iconography of the 1-up thing, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say because like the 1-up mushroom is kind of iconic, so maybe that's the only reason they're even there. And also but that doesn't really explain Donkey Kong Country Returns, in my opinion. Like those balloons, are they iconic to anyone? I mean,
well, Donkey Kong Country Returns, do you think it's handled badly in that game? I think it's handled pretty well in that game for the most part.
It is, I guess, except that I've read posts from people who ran out of lives and had to basically grind for them, and I definitely didn't have that problem. I had like always over like 60. I don't know. So like obviously it wasn't enough for some people, and it was too many lives for other people.
Yeah, it's not worthless like in Galaxy or the 3D Mario games, though. I mean, they actually serve a purpose. That's how they designed the game on purpose, you know.
Well, the way it works in Donkey Kong is that when you die, you're sent back to the checkpoint. If you haven't got to the checkpoint, you know, it'd be the beginning of the level. And when you get a game over, you're kicked out of the level, basically. So you can still save between levels. But if you want to, you know, if you're doing a really hard level and you get to the checkpoint and you want to spend the rest of your lives, you know, trying to get to the end part, if you lose too many lives, your punishment is basically being having to do that first part again. So I guess that's why you want more lives, so you have more chances in that second part.
Yeah, but why not have, like, unlimited lives? Like, those balloons, they don't mean anything to anyone, I think. Like, unlike the 1-Up Mushrooms, where it's kind of cool to get them, I don't see really the appeal of those balloons.
Everybody likes balloons.
Yeah, that's kind of the question I'm wondering. Like, should we have unlimited lives in games like this? With Donkey Kong, it's a 2D platformer, so lives kind of... I don't know, they kind of fit with that genre more than other games, I think. But
I think open games in general discourage lives, the lives mechanic, and linear games kind of encourage it.
Well, what do y'all think should be the punishment for losing, basically? Like, how far back should you be set?
So basically, you've got, let's say, Mario Galaxy, where your ultimate goal is to get that star, and you've got these lives that really don't mean anything to you. Why not have a secondary goal, where a group of boards, you have to collect all these coins within these, you know, worlds or these boards to get some kind of, I don't know, extra board. And if a game over were to happen, you lose all those coins.
I do think Nintendo kind of missed the ball in not having time trials and things like that in Mario Galaxy. I mean, it would have been pretty easy to implement, like, either coin, you know, coin trials or time trials or something, and I think it might have extended the game somewhat with leaderboards and stuff.
Well, I don't think you guys have played Super Meat Boy at all.
Yeah, Super Meat Boy I've played it.
Oh, okay.
And Bitrip Runner is kind of also similar.
Yeah, but Super Meat Boy, like, actually, Abdu just said, talked about something that that game does. The regular levels, you've got unlimited lives, so you can just throw yourself against saw blades all you want and explode in bloody chunks. And at some point... hopefully you get to the end and you win, and you feel pretty happy about that. But also, there's like you can also find these warp zones, and like they lead you to maybe like a batch of 3 levels that you have to complete with a limited number of lives.
Oh.
So yeah, it's just like this extra thing that you know the people who have mastered the game can go try and do complete. So. Yeah, do you think that would be a good solution?
I think that's kind of a neat idea to have a reward, basically, instead of punishing a player too much for dying, to have a reward, basically, for not dying too much, like you said. I don't know what the best way to implement that would be, but it seems like a good way to encourage players to play better.
Even the normal levels of Super Meat Boy, though, it is a pretty interesting mechanic of lives and things like that, because you restart instantly, so even though you die, like, all the time, you just restart instantly, so you just keep going and going until your hand starts to ache, you know, and throb. But, yeah, so I think, and Bit Trip Runner is the same way, where it actually, it does kind of punish you, but, you know, is it really punishment? Because don't you feel the tension actually makes it more fun? Like, in the old days, they made you start at the beginning of the game because they didn't have that much content. You know, if you buy a game for $50, yeah, like Castlevania or something, and it's like the whole game is like 25 minutes or something, and you beat it the first day, then, you know, you feel like you got gypped. So they had a reason for doing it in those days. But I think it also, when you play those old games now, it's kind of refreshing, you know, with, mm-hmm, with the context of the modern industry. And it feels like, yeah, like I actually care about whether I can make this jump, you know?
Yeah, it's not like it just kind of increases the intensity.
Yeah, so I think it's actually good in a lot of ways, as long as it's not, I mean, the galaxies, it doesn't need to be there, but in like something like a modern 2D platformer, I have no problem with it, even though other people do, which is, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know, like, I really like the way that Super Meat Boy and Bit Trip Runner just restart immediately, as you said, and I don't think that the tension is really lost when you play those games, you know? It's really, they're so hard, and I don't think that just because you've got infinite lives, you take it for granted that you're eventually going to finish the level.
It's true. Those things are tense in like a different way, though. It's not like, yeah, they are tense, though.
and pretty addictive.
Yeah.
I thought Beautiful Joe did a good job with the live and continue system, basically. And it kind of ties back into the RPG elements almost, in that your score, like, the better you play, the more of these Vs you get. And, you know, you can buy life with that, and that carries over from you dying.
So we're back to RPG-style leveling?
Well, I guess it does kind of tie back into that. But you have infinite continues. You just have a certain number of lives, basically. And, you know, that was a game that came to mind when I was thinking of games that still feel very intense, even if I have infinite number of continues, because it's very difficult, and it requires a lot of the player. And, you know, I think life systems still have a place in games like that, where you have a certain number of lives to get to the end of a long, difficult level.
Have you guys played Maximo for the PlayStation 2, which was originally supposed to be on the Nintendo 64?
It's too hard.
that game it's pretty awesome, first of all. It's like sort of an evolution of Ghouls and Ghosts that they never gave the actual Ghosts and Goblins name to. But I think it's actually really good, and a really, like a faithful kind of adaptation of all the kind of just the brutality of Ghosts and Goblins. And the way the save system is set up, it's pretty hardcore, quote unquote. It's like you have to buy your saves. I mean, you have to buy your resurrections, and every single time you have to spend more and more coins to resurrect yourself. So if you use them all up early, then, you know, you won't have enough coins to resurrect yourself when the game gets really tough. So, you know, it's kind of, but I think the game was actually a lot more fun because of that kind of brutality. Like, it really, like I said before, it encourages mastery. You know, you just get the worlds down to the point where you can just walk through them, even though they're so challenging before. And that's the kind of thing, like, I don't think games really encourage mastery these days. It's pretty rare, you know?
But Maximo is a 3D game, and I think that it's not really the same thing than with 2D games. Like, there's always this, like, having to deal with the camera, either whether you control it or not. In Maximo, you don't. But there's always, like, this imprecision that you don't have in 2D platformers. So
That's true, yeah.
The whole save system in Maximo really turned me off the game, to be honest. Like, I wasn't driven to master these levels. I was just like, oh, wow, I'm not going to bother with this again.
But to me, the challenge didn't come from the actual platforming in that so much as just navigating the levels and, you know, killing the enemies at the same time as you are platforming. I don't know. I thought it was a pretty faithful, good transition from 2D to 3D. Like, one of the best, I thought. Like, it really felt like Ghosts and Goblins to me, because, like, the ground rises up. And, I mean, Ghosts and Goblins was equally kind of just, like, kick you in the ass for playing it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it seems like they're going the other way now, you know, with all these help systems that they're implementing.
Yeah, tutorials. It's like everyone must beat their game so they can see their cutscenes.
And I think, like, just like us, like, those things add tension. Having no tension whatsoever really hurts a game for me. I mean, some people may just want, like, interactive stories, but what's the point of kind of playing to me? It's like, it loses, like, a big essential part of video gaming. What video gaming was, that arcade sort of, you know, challenge yourself and sort of rise to the next level.
You bringing up that system in Maximo kind of reminds me of the one in the Resident Evil remake.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, with the limited number of typewriter inks, to where it sort of discourages you from saving, which is, and when you die, you get sent back to your last save point. So
even the original Resident Evil, it's the same system.
So like on one hand, it's kind of annoying, but on the other hand, it's like makes the game really intense, like even more than you think, because you're trying to preserve your saves even.
And that whole game is about preserving your resources.
It's like a double-edged sword, you know. I kind of like it, but I kind of it makes me freak out a lot. I don't know. And when you die and you have to get set back like 2 hours, it's pretty maddening. But at the same time, it gives you this really intense experience, though.
I think the ultimate extreme of this is Shiren the Wanderer, which is an RPG that's on the DS, and Shiren the Wanderer. It's been on a bunch of systems. It's basically a roguelike, and you know the essentials of a roguelike are it's randomly generated. There's different floors you go through, different enemies on each floor, things like that. But you know, it's just totally brutal because it's a role-playing game, but it's like an arcade role-playing game almost. And if you die, even if you've been playing for half an hour, when you die, you just lose everything. You get wiped out, you know? So it really encourages, like, it sort of, like, feeds into everything we were talking about because it encourages, you know, you can't hoard items. You have to play like your life depends on it all the time. And it's super tense. And I think it's actually pretty fun. And you actually do improve and get a little bit farther every time. And that's, you know, it's an extreme, but I think that works too, even though it's kind of masochistic.
Well, that's cool. Yeah, I like these non-conventional saving conventions a little more than the whole excess save points and save states.
As long as the game is tailored for these save points, I think that they can be pretty good. Like, okay, my example is a PS3 game, Infamous. Like while I was playing it, I thought that like the checkpoints were really plentiful. You know, you never restarted far from where you died, but the game was still hard enough that like each step was kind of a struggle. So I do think that you can have checkpoints and still have that rewarding feeling.
Yeah,
Metroid and Castlevania have another unique sort of thing where you don't even know where the checkpoints are. Kind of like the Metroidvania is kind of, and Metroid, you just have to kind of explore, and if you haven't come across a checkpoint, then it is kind of like also tense until you find the checkpoint and get it on your map or whatever. Mm-hmm. Kind of interesting wrinkle, but yeah, it can definitely be balanced and designed well, so the checkpoints basically break like a long game into discrete segments, right? So
right,
it can be done well for sure.
Well, yeah, it can definitely be done well. I think. In some games, it's being used way too much, basically, to the point where gamers will just, you know, keep trying to push through this next segment just to get to the next part without really developing their skills at all.
So we should all go back and play Battletoads until we beat it?
Yes.
Well, at least, like, it's not, like, it's some games, yeah, that take it too far, but it's not every game, and there seems to be a whole lot of these indie games that really take to heart the whole idea of making impossible challenges.
Yeah, definitely the new indie games that have been doing that.
Yeah.
Demon's Souls.
Well, yeah. Is that an indie game? That was Sony.
No, it's not an indie game, but it's kind of
a convention. It's pretty ridiculous, yeah.
All right. Well, that's pretty much it for this topic, and that's pretty much it for this podcast. Thanks for being here, guys.
Yeah, no problem. It was fun.
If someone who's listening to this who is not actually a regular on Negative World. first, like, I would really like your comments. And first, you know, most important, I would like to know how the hell you found the podcast. So, like, you can, like, visit us on negativeworld.org and sign up and post your comments. But if you don't want to do that, I can understand. Like, some people don't really want to sign up for something just to, I would still want your feedback. So Negative World actually has a Facebook page. Just look for Negative World on Facebook and you're going to find it. And, we've even got a Twitter account. It's negative_world. And, those are two other ways that you can reach us, but none of them are as effective as actually showing up on Negative World. And, you know, on Negative World, it's not just the podcast. Like, we do all sorts of other fun stuff. For instance, we're doing, like, a retro game club right now with we're playing Star Tropics together, or at least some of us are playing it.
I'm playing it. I love Star
Tropics. And also a less retro game club of Okami.
Yeah. So it's a fun place to be. So come visit us, and you know, maybe you'll want to hang out, and you'll give us the opportunity to learn to love you, really. That's all we ask.
But not in a creepy way.
Oh, I totally meant it a creepy way.
Oh, sorry.
Also, if actually what would really help us if you rated us on iTunes, and if you're a complete noob like me, you probably, or maybe I'm the only one who had that problem. I rated the episodes in my library, and that's not what you're supposed to do. You have to go on the iTunes marketplace and rate this podcast. And if we get enough good ratings, then more people will listen, and that's what we want. So, thanks for listening, for sticking with us for this whole time. And if there are some audio problems, I'm really sorry. That means I failed as an editor. But mostly...
Most of it is probably my fault.
Yeah, I was going to say, mostly it's that these guys have failed you.
Yeah,
that's actually Abdu's fault, if you want a name to put it on.
Oh, what? Okay. And we're going to leave that in. Okay, so thanks for listening, and see you in 2 weeks, hopefully.
Thanks for listening.
Bye. That's the end of the podcast.
So what are you guys wearing, really?
Oh.
I got like a shirt and some pants.
Very, very casual.
Yes, I draw about Nintendo.
Cool. This is the first time I think that a celebrity is on our podcast.
is that what I'm qualified as, in a celebrity?
Well, like relatively, I guess.
All right, okay, cool.
Because otherwise we're just a bunch of nerds from a board that I'm not sure why anyone from outside the world would listen to us. But actually,
I didn't want to tell you guys, but I have a little surprise. I found a guest that he's kind of a celebrity. I mean, should I bring him on?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's hear him.
Okay. Well, yeah, over here. Hello. My name is Satoru Iwata. Today... I would like to talk about Nintendo.
Iwata, man, I want to hear about your Blue Ocean strategy.
The Blue Ocean strategy is part of our business. Okay, that's enough. Continue.
That's a great strategy, Mr. Iwata.
You took all my points away.
Arigato gozaimasu.
That was pretty good.
Oh, man. I don't know. This is terrible. I think we should start over.